The most potent words in macroeconomics today, for the time being. The Fed meets, Janet Yellen speaks from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 21st of September. Good to have you along, everybody. Item one, the Fed. No change in interest rates, as basically everybody expected. Item two, also the Fed. Hang on to your hats, because those rate hikes, they are a-coming. As she does four times a year, Chair Janet Yellen did a press conference after the Federal Open Market Committee's meeting wrapped up, at which she said this.
We judge that the case for an increase has strengthened, but decided for the time being to wait for further evidence of continued progress toward our objectives.
For the time being, that's a whole new phrase. Got to pay attention to that one. The basic takeaway, though, is this. Economy is pretty good, according to the Fed. They are ready to raise rates, just not yet, for some reason. All right, moving on. The Washington Post has been doing some digging into the Trump Foundation, the charity that Donald Trump set up back in 1987. And according to the paper, the foundation's tax returns show that Trump has spent more than $250,000 of the foundation's money, that is money donated by others, to settle legal disputes involving his businesses. The term of art for that is self-dealing, which is more than just unethical. It can be illegal. Marketplace's Amy Scott has this explainer.
Let's say a lawyer representing an estate is supposed to sell a house from the estate's assets, then turns around and sells it to himself. Or a stockbroker, knowing her client is about to unload a big chunk of stock and drive down the price, sells her own shares ahead of her clients. Daniel Ostis, who teaches business ethics at the University of Oklahoma, says that's self-dealing.
Doing something that's going to benefit yourself when you're supposed to be acting as a fiduciary for another.
Fiduciary is just a fancy word for trusted person. And in the case of the Trump Foundation, Donald Trump would be a fiduciary, acting on behalf of the foundation and its donors. There are specific tax regulations for private foundations, saying they can't use their assets to benefit foundation insiders. But according to the Post, Trump businesses twice settled lawsuits by agreeing to make donations to charity.
Now, if Trump had just written the check to the charity, no problem.
That's law professor Lloyd Meyer at Notre Dame. According to the Post, the checks came from the Trump Foundation.
That's clearly self-dealing, using the charity's assets to benefit himself and his business interests.
The Trump campaign did not respond to a request for comment. Attorney Beth Kingsley with Harmon Curran says because private foundations benefit from tax breaks, they're held to a certain standard.
They're not private business slush funds. They are organizations that are supposed to have a mission to further the public good in some way.
And if the IRS finds wrongdoing, Kingsley says a self-dealer can be ordered to give the money back to the foundation and pay a tax penalty. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
21 states filed suit today challenging the Obama administration's new overtime rules that are set to take effect on December the 1st. The rule essentially doubles the salary cap under which employers have to pay people overtime from about $23,000 a year to $47,000 a year, plus or minus. Under that, you have to pay people overtime. States, as well as a number of business groups, argue that that is going to make companies cut full-time jobs and turn salaried workers into hourly ones. Gigi Duban has more on that.
Nevada relies on tourism, and it's just now recovering from the recession. So Lawrence Van Dyke, the state's solicitor general, says to have the new overtime rules piled on now could have devastating effects in both the private and public sectors.
Now the money has to come out of something. You know, what services is it going to be taken from? Are we going to have to raise taxes to cover this?
Nevada led the charge of states challenging the Labor Department's new rule, which says that employees who earn less than $913 a week are eligible for overtime. One big worry is a provision that the government will revisit the salary level cutoff every 3 years. Van Dyke says, what if there's another recession then? Until now,
all of the affected entities, states, would say, you know, we don't have the money to do this. Please, please, please don't do this.
But he says the threshold reviews put that on autopilot, so there's no way to fight it. Karen Harned is executive director of the Small Business Legal Center. She says businesses operating on thin margins and their employees will feel the pinch.
They're going to limit the hours to 40, right? And they're going to convert these people to hourly.
But Jesse Rothstein, who teaches economics at UC Berkeley, says the new rules don't necessarily mean a financial blow to employers. Workers can factor in overtime.
If they know that they're going to be getting overtime, then they can agree to accept a job at a lower base wage than they would have been willing to if they were just going to be expected to work those hours without compensation.
As for the automatic reviews, Rothstein says the threshold has been allowed to erode due to inflation for decades. This just keeps us caught up. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Remember how I've been saying all week that traders have been waiting for the Fed? Yeah, they're not waiting anymore. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While law enforcement builds its case against Ahmad Khan Rahami, the man accused in the New York and New Jersey bombings this past weekend, they are also following a supply chain of sorts because at least two of the bombs were made using items any of us could pick up at almost any shopping mall across the country. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains how difficult that can make things.
The materials you can use to make a bomb can be so mundane, it can seem almost surreal.
You know, I was involved in discussions a long time ago about pie tins.
So, wow, pie tins.
I know. It was one of the weirder moments of my government career.
Now, James Lewis is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But he used to work with the Department of State and says, yeah, you can use pie tins to make a bomb.
You know, some people said, gee, we ought to find a way to control pie tins. And it's like, get a grip.
He says if the government started tracking pressure cookers, terrorists would just find something else.
Pursuing everything that could be used to do harm is just a fruitless task.
Instead of law enforcement tracking our pots and pans, Lewis says we should keep an eye on people, the ones who make bombs, potentially including surveilling our communications. But if we really wanted to track the sale of pressure cookers, we could.
Certainly technically possible.
William Banks is director of the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism at Syracuse University. He says, look no farther than fertilizer and think back to Oklahoma City, 1995. Before that, fertilizer was something we thought of for farmers to grow more crops. Then it was used in a massive bombing that killed 168 people.
After the Oklahoma City bombings, we decided to tag and then monitor the sale and use of many of those materials. We could do that again.
Except Banks says we shouldn't. For consumers, being watched while shopping would mean privacy issues. And for everyone else, it would mean a lot of extra work.
You know, retailers and wholesalers would say, oh my God, you know, every time I sell a pressure cooker now, I've got to fill out a piece of paper.
At a colorful Brooklyn houseware store, which sells a couple of models of pressure cookers, Preet Verdi is shopping for a salad bowl. She says watching what we buy isn't enough anyway.
People need to know that extremism is just not about a pressure cooker. It's about why that person bought a pressure cooker to begin with.
Luckily, most of the time, it's because they just want to make stew. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The Hollywood news of the day comes via Beijing. Dalian Wanda, the Chinese conglomerate that bought AMC Theaters back in 2012, is set to close a multi-billion-dollar deal with Sony Pictures. Deadline Hollywood reports the deal is going to give Wanda a slice of Sony's big franchise movies, the ones that appeal to global audiences. Funnily enough, a couple of weeks ago, I sat down with the guy who almost certainly had a hand in brokering that deal. His name is Dominic Ng, and he is arguably the most important banker on the U.S.-China economic axis. He's the CEO of East West Bank in Pasadena, California, and he spends his time connecting Chinese investors with American companies, especially those in the film business. So when we sat down a couple of weeks ago, as I said, I asked him how that came to pass.
Well, I think it's more of a natural for East West. We looked at strategically what are the type of industries in U.S. that is important to China.
Yeah.
Today, Chinese box office ticket sales over $7 billion. 2017, China will exceed United States. So from that standpoint, I see that the growth is going to be tremendous. And it's just natural for the Chinese studios who wanted to come to California in Hollywood to learn how to produce and make global movies.
When you come in on a Monday morning, do you look at the Chinese box office receipts for the previous weekend?
Absolutely.
Do you?
Yeah. because that is critical to us. We need to know what's working, what's not working, who's doing well, who's not doing well, because most of the Chinese studios in China are clients of East West Bank. Yeah. And so we got to keep up with it.
What's it like for you to be stuck between two economies, really? I mean, you have to please people in both areas, in both countries, when their interests don't always necessarily align.
You're absolutely true. The interests not necessarily align. And also, oftentimes, there are a lot of cultural differences.
Yeah.
That's what East West come into play. Our position is that I think it makes me very happy, and then most of our associates here are excited about doing our job. I mean, banker is a kind of boring job. You know? And, you know, with the last 6 years, you know, there are enough people trashing banks, you know.
Yeah.
So we looked at it as how do we keep our spirit up and have a good sort of like good spirit to go out and work. I mean, every one of these deals that we worked on, we feel good about East West play a role to help bridge the gap.
The Chinese economy right now is slowing, right, from its amazing growth rate. The American economy, while not super strong, is doing okay. Does that make your life more complicated?
It does to a certain degree. A Chinese economy is not going reverse. It's just the growth rate is slowing down. But one has to always look at, in long term, the largest and the second largest economy in this global setting just have to work together. And there's going to be plenty of business to do. I mean, I think since 2008, 2009, when President Obama kept urging the Chinese president to bring in the entourage of investors to come U.S., as we have witnessed, massive investment are coming in. And these investments are creating great jobs for U.S. And that's something that we should always keep that in mind, you know.
What do you make of the tendency of American politicians to demonize China economically, to go after it for, and you hear this all the time, currency manipulation and unfair trade practices? Do you think there's a way that the American political system can acknowledge the realities of the economic relationship that we have with the Chinese?
I don't think so. Not in any near future.
That's discouraging.
Yeah, not in any near future. The reason I say that is that I think that there's the challenge of democracy is such that, particularly the American democracy, which a two-party system, it is a zero-sum game. Because either the Democrat win or the Republican win, and then there is so much of the focus about, well, we not only need to get the presidential seat, but we also need to make sure we control Congress and so forth, of the Supreme Court. When there is so much of the winning based on the party affiliation, you can't get productive and getting work done.
I wonder if you want to get bigger, because it's good for banks to get bigger, but maybe not too big so that you can sort of, and I say this not pejoratively, but so that you can fly below the radar a little bit of the bad attention that banks get in this country sometimes.
You're absolutely right. And the nice thing about where we are today, if you look at my day-to-day activities, yes, I'm managing the bank. I mean, looking at the operation, assessing risk, but also I'm out there on a daily basis with our clients. So I'm never too big to fail, you know. And we never got into subprime and then all these derivative stuff. We just focusing on taking care of our clients one customer at a time.
Dominic Ng, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Coming up.
It's not about the team. It's about you, your face, your name, your stats.
Like it or not, fantasy football is changing the actual game. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 163 points today, 0.9%, 18,293 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 53 points, about 1%, 5,295. The S&P 500 lifted 23 points, 1%. 2163. Might have won a bunch of Emmys last weekend, but Netflix had its own drama today. Shares dropped after plans to increase spending on original shows coincided with reports of canceled subscriptions. Uh-oh, Netflix down 3.4%. Meanwhile, FedEx delivered good news to its shareholders. It beat earnings estimates and forecast a busy holiday season. Shares up 6.8% today. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Puerto Rico is in some economic difficulty, as you know, so this next sentence is not going to surprise you. The Puerto Rican government says 1,000 or so families move to Florida every month, a lot of them to Central Florida in particular. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent a week talking to people down there to get a sense of how this migration of American citizens, it has to be said, is changing that community.
A lot of newly arrived Puerto Ricans come to Kissimmee, near Orlando. County officials sometimes refer to it as the gateway to Disney World, which means there's a ton of motels lining its main road, Highway 192. But you're not going to mistake these for Disney resorts. They're budget motels built in the 70s and 80s. And it's where a lot of Puerto Rican families end up. Mike Steigerwald is the city manager.
We have an aspect of homelessness that is not recognized by the federal government as technically homelessness. What we're finding is that these folks are taking up residence in motel rooms, and they're not suitable for it.
Most of these motels, for example, don't have kitchens or separate bedrooms for the kids. Kissimmee's population has increased by 10,000 since 2010, nearly 20%. City officials are reluctant to say Puerto Rican migration is solely responsible, but there's no denying its role. You can see it along Highway 192, where a lot of shopping center billboards are in Spanish. There's even a restaurant, La Lechonera El Jibarito, that's painted like a Puerto Rican flag. During the Great Migration to the mainland after World War II, the majority that came over were laborers. They got service jobs in places like New York and Connecticut. Now that things are much worse on the island, it's not just unskilled workers migrating. A lot of the people moving here are teachers, engineers, or nurses. Again, Mike Steigerwald.
That initial wave of migrants were really here for the service industry. And what we're seeing now is more educated, more skilled workforce that is moving here from Puerto Rico.
He says most of today's migrants still end up getting jobs at Disney or at hotels because the degree they got in Puerto Rico might not be recognized here or their English isn't fluent enough. But there's no denying the advantages of moving here from Puerto Rico as opposed to immigrating from Mexico or Cuba. These folks are American citizens, which means getting work is much less complicated. Kevin Curtici grew up in Central Florida. We met at a restaurant called Puerto Rico's Cafe. He works in the restaurant business and says he sees tension between the Latino communities all the time.
You know, to put it simple, it's jealousy. It's really easy to come over here. You just get a plane ticket from Puerto Rico and jump right on board. Grab a job, get a license, and, you know, get whatever you need to do. Whereas, you know, coming from Mexico, it's a struggle for those guys.
Walter Burial says it's not that simple. He moved from the island 10 years ago.
It goes back to Puerto Ricans being considered immigrants when that is completely wrong. Automatically, because you speak Spanish, you're assumed to be an immigrant.
And Walter speaks Spanish most of the time. His English is great, but it's still his second language. Esther Rivera moved to Kissimmee with her husband and three kids 4 years ago. She says Puerto Ricans start learning English in grade school, but the majority don't practice, and they speak Spanish at home.
You don't practice because you don't have to. You are around the people. You don't have to practice the English. That's what I say. You get stuck because you don't have to. You don't get forced to use it.
She was a nurse on the island and her husband was unemployed. Now he's a janitor at Disney and his salary lets her stay at home with the kids. This year, they moved out of Kissimmee.
There is like a city. It's inside the city. There's too many Puerto Ricans there. There's too many Latins there. The opportunities are less because everyone wants to work. So that was the major thing that we decide we can't stay here because it's going to be the same thing like Puerto Rico.
Most of the folks I met were born on the island and told me they consider themselves Puerto Ricans living in Florida, not Floridians. And almost to a person, they want to get back to the island. That is, if things get better there. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Over the past couple of decades or so, men and women and boys and girls have found entertainment and money in pretending to be the owners of imaginary professional sports teams on the internet. There are more than 30 million people in this country, just for instance, playing fantasy football alone. One of those people is Nate Jackson. And when he played for the Denver Broncos a decade or so ago, he was somebody's fantasy player. Today, he's just like us, playing fantasy football himself and writing about it. His newest book is called Fantasy Man. Nate, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I will tell you, I am now in a fantasy league at my house because my 17-year-old son was like, Dad, we're doing this. We got it. And he turned it into a thing, man. I mean, we got him and his girlfriend and all the whole family. And we sat around and I'm like, dude, I don't even know what I'm doing. And he's like, no, Dad, look at the numbers. Look at the right. That. And it's huge now. I mean, it's enormous.
It's a big moneymaker for the NFL, for ESPN. They attract a lot of new eyeballs. They get people involved that might not otherwise. And so in that way, I think it's good. But it is changing the way that people view the game.
Oh, that's interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, the loyalty to a particular team is kind of gone. What you're loyal to now is your own fantasy team, and you would rather have your own fantasy team win than the team that you grew up supporting.
I happen to agree with you, but it makes you and me sound like the old guy going, hey, you kids, get off my lawn, because this is clearly the wave of the future, right? This is how people are doing sports, not just football, but baseball and basketball and all that.
Yeah, possibly from a fan's perspective, but from the ground level when you're on a sports team and you're trying to win, you know, the kind of some of the old adages in football is it's not about you, it's about the guy next to you.
Right.
It's about your team. And what fantasy football does is it just kind of blows that to smithereens and says it's not about the team, it's about you, your face, your name, your stats.
Since we're on football as a sport and a business, as an enterprise, I wonder if sometimes you think, as you read about the concussions and about the injuries and about all the things that are happening in the NFL today, if maybe you played just long enough and you got out just in time to preserve some semblance of your brain, obviously, and also your body. I mean,
yeah, I definitely had my share of injuries over the years. I do think I left the game with my mind intact, relatively. Mm-hmm. I feel pretty good. I think a lot of the problems that players run into when they're done is not knowing what to do with themselves. They've been conditioned since little kids to be football players. Mm-hmm. All the doors that have opened up for them have been football doors and adults opening those doors. But back when I played, we didn't know about this concussion stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in the lexicon. Our trainers didn't discuss it.
It wasn't even that long ago. It was 2008 you left, right?
I mean, yeah, and we never had a word from our trainers about head injuries, about concussions. It was one of those things where you just don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Because in high school, I learned what it feels like to get my bell rung. Yep. That's what they would call you. Yep. And really, that's probably like a mild brain injury right there. Yeah. But we didn't know that. We just thought that was part of football, being tough. And that's kind of the difficult part in diagnosing concussions, is getting guys to admit that they're symptomatic, which in football it's taboo to admit that you're feeling anything.
I wonder if in football, more possibly than in other major league sports, because it is so physical and in the long run debilitating, I wonder if the players, because certainly they would never say it, most of them would never say it, those who are playing now, but you guys are really just pawns, right? And it's a $9 billion a year enterprise, the NFL, or more now.
More, yeah.
And you guys get shuttled in and out as fodder.
Yeah, there's no loyalty. The team doesn't have a lot of loyalty to players individually. They get shuffled around the league. They're faceless behemoths wearing face masks.
Right.
And, you know, when they get hurt, they drag them off the field and put someone else on there, and you never really see the trail of blood.
When you watch, do you watch as if... You're in a fantasy league now, I'm sure.
Yeah, right?
All right, so
three.
Three. Yeah. When you watch, do you watch as a fantasy guy, thinking, you know, hey, the running back's doing really well?
But, a little bit. Yeah, sadly. I mean, it's seeped into my blood. I want to watch these individuals do well so I can beat my buddy, so I can make fun of him. You know, otherwise he's coming at me.
Right.
But to me, these days, the product is becoming a little bit sterilized because these coaches are shuffled from team to team to team to team.
Right.
They all watch film of each other. They're stealing each other's plays. The players are shuffled from team to team. They have the same athletic trainers. And so it feels very watered down to me. It's very predictable. I wish a coach would be creative a little more, try something that has never been tried
before.
Yeah,
but the stakes are so high, right?
They are.
There's gazillions of dollars on the line. There's winning, you know?
And if you do something that the industry doesn't approve of,
forget it.
They let you know about it that next morning. There's so much media surrounding the game that they keep guys in the box for sure.
Nate Jackson used to play with the Denver Broncos. His most recent book is called Fantasy Man. Nate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, one more item about the Fed and Donald Trump's claim last week that Chair Yellen and her colleagues are keeping interest rates low as a political favor to President Obama. Dr. Yellen was asked a version of this question four times today. Is that true? Here's one of her answers in its entirety.
I have no concern that the Fed is politically motivated, and I will assure you that you will not find any signs of political motivation when the transcripts are released in 5 years. It is important that we maintain the confidence of the public, and I do believe that we deserve it. I know that these are difficult decisions, and everybody may not agree with them, but I hope the public will understand that we're striving to do our best to pursue these goals that do matter to all of us.
Next meeting and rate decision as it happens, November 1st and 2nd. That is, check your calendar, 6 days before Election Day. All right, suffice it to say that Wall Street liked the Fed rate decision today, up all the way around. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.